Hey everyone, this is Joe Turner. Before we hop into the next episode of the City Manager Unfiltered podcast, I wanted to share a couple of thoughts with you. I've had so many people reach out over the last year and a half, say, you know what, Joe, you're saying the things that nobody else feels comfortable saying, and we appreciate what you're putting out there. You're the voice that we need, and what can we do to support you? What can we do to help you out? And up to this point, outside of asking for likes and ratings and reviews on the podcast, there hasn't really been much you could do because I haven't been monetizing the platform or the podcast. I recently launched the newsletter, the City Manager RTRs and Job Board newsletter that's going out each week on LinkedIn. I have over 5,500 subscribers at this point. And if you really want to help out, if you really want to support what I'm doing, if you have a senior level department head vacancy or an executive level vacancy in your organization, and you're a city manager, an HR director listening to this podcast, then please put your listing in the newsletter. It's only $100 to put your job listing in there, and you're going to get national reach, national exposure to a very niche, highly targeted audience of public sector executives and those passive candidates who aren't actively trolling job boards, right? But they're looking at what is going on in the industry with their peers, who's coming and going, and they're passively looking at these job ads, which, as you know, are some of the most valued prospective candidates out there. So if you really like what I'm doing, please put your job listings in the newsletter. It'd be a great help to me. It doesn't cost you personally any money at all, and it's a great value for your organization. If you would like to do that, check in the show notes. There's a link to the form that you fill out. You simply provide me a little bit of information. It's only going to cost you $100. I will invoice you at the end of the month. And thank you for your support. Before we hop into this very powerful and riveting episode with a city manager in Texas who was arrested on a domestic violence charge, I want to give you a sneak peek on a special announcement that my buddy Micah Gaudet and I are going to make on May 1st. As you all know, Micah Gaudet's been on the program several times. He's become a ChatGPT AI thought leader in the public sector. He created the first and only ChatGPT AI course for public sector employees, and he's just been doing great work over the last year. Him and I are going to be embarking on a joint venture, a project that I think many of you are going to enjoy and want to participate in. I can't wait to share that with you, but we're going to make a very special announcement on May 1st about this adventure we're going to be embarking on, and we're going to invite you all to participate with us. So please stay tuned for that very special announcement on May 1st. We're really excited to share it with you. Now, with all that out of the way, we're going to turn to this episode. It's a two-part episode. Part two will be released next week. I hope you enjoy it. Thank you very much for your support. If you like what you're hearing, if you like the content, please don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss an episode. And please don't forget to leave a rating and review, especially on Apple and Spotify. I'm really trying to get those numbers up, and I'm trying to get to that 200 mark before the one-year anniversary of the podcast. So please, leave a rating and review. It'd mean a lot to me. All right. I'm Joe Turner, and this is the City Manager Unfiltered podcast, a podcast for city managers and other public sector executives. It is the most influential local government podcast in America, and I have a very interesting guest with us here today. His name's Theo. I'm going to leave out his last name for a second because we're going to have a little bit of a pronunciation lesson here. Theo and I connected a long time ago, a little over a year ago, early on, back in, I think it was probably October-ish or so of 2022. I had posted a story about how he had locked horns with his police chief. Police chief been there for a long time, and how he had locked horns and had successfully, we'll just call it, forced the police chief out. We'll get into semantics maybe a little bit later, whether it's fired or a resignation or what have you. And I just talked about in my post about how it takes some brass balls for a city manager to lock horns with a longstanding police chief who's very popular, has a lot of power in the community. And it's a very important issue that I think doesn't really get talked about in the profession enough is what should a city manager do? How should a city manager navigate those treacherous waters when you have a police chief who is entrenched in the community and they're really not doing the job that needs to be done and that there needs to be a change? And so I wanted to bring Theo on to the podcast to talk about his experience and maybe teach us all a thing or two. I've gone down this rodeo myself with a police chief I had to fire. So we're gonna have a very interesting discussion today. Theo, why don't you introduce yourself, including both pronunciations of your last name, and give us a little bit of a background with respect to your career and how you got to Dickinson, Texas.
Thank you for having me, Joe. I'm very happy to be here. Couple of pronunciations. I'm from South Louisiana, so my last name is pronounced Melanson. But normally, I just tell people it's Melanson, seems a little softer for most native English speakers. So born and raised in South Louisiana, as my last name would attest to. Went to college in South Louisiana, graduated, you know, with a bachelor's in history. I love history. Thought I was going to be a professor at some point until I, you know, kind of researched salaries for history professors. And I said, well, that's not going to work. So after that, I get a master's in public administration jointly with a law degree from Louisiana State University. Kind of during my classes in the MPA program, I saw this job title I had never heard of before in a case study, and it was called a city manager. I'd never heard of anything like that because in Louisiana, there's maybe six cities that have city managers. It's a strong mayor system in Louisiana. And so it was really fascinating and intriguing to me that somebody would be able to not just affect change, but affect it in very tangible ways. Because my expectation was to work in state government. That's what everyone aspires to in Louisiana, because that's where all the jobs are. And you know, I kind of started working in that realm for a little while, and I would see these, very Dilbert-esque, like moving paper from one box to the other, and I did not like that at all. So this job appealed to me, and so I applied to over 120 jobs, was rejected for every single one of them except for one that invited me for an interview, and I got the job off of that interview. So I had a little tenacity because I knew it was what I wanted to do.
We didn't cover this in the pre-interview screen here, Theo. So we got to unpack this a second. Okay, so you're in Louisiana. You're getting your master's in public administration. And when you went to go get your master's, did you know at that point in time that there was such a thing as city manager? Or did you learn about the city manager in your MPA school?
No, I actually took a class in state and local government, and the professor was actually, we were just doing case studies, and that was the first time. I was actually kind of in my second year of my MPA / second year of law school at that moment. So I was kind of mid-track on that joint degree program, and I read about it in a case study.
Ah, interesting. Okay. And then so when you apply for 120 jobs, are you applying for 120 management analyst positions? Or what do you mean? You applied for 120 city administrator, city manager jobs out of the gate? Walk us through that.
I went straight for the top. I wasn't.
No time to waste, right? No time to waste.
Hey, no better time than the present, you know?
So you literally applied to 100 plus city administrator, city manager jobs. Is this all across the country? And then you got rejected, and then you finally landed a gig?
Yeah. So, I mean, I applied to almost every state in the country. I mean, I didn't have a family. I mean, I was coming out of university. Yeah. I was like, you know, I was looking for the opportunity. I was going to go to the opportunity.
Absolutely. The right mindset to have. In fact, I would argue aspiring city managers who even have families now that want to become a city manager, now there's no time like the present now to take that risk and put your career on an awesome trajectory by being able to relocate and seize an opportunity. So you applied everywhere, and then who hired you? I mean,
Who
pranked you, Theo? You must have got that. This must have been back in the days when you get an envelope in the mail, maybe, that says, "Hey, we want you to interview for this position."
it was actually kind of funny because I had always been applying on like the TML website. I'd find it in all these state boards, job boards, but one town in West Texas, El Dorado, and they know that you're not a local if you pronounce it El Dorado. So what happens is I'm actually looking, and I'm getting kind of, I don't know, best way to put it was, you know, when you get 100, and at that point it was probably a little over 115 rejections at that point. And it was kind of cool though, because they used to give you these really nice little postcards telling you thanks, but no thanks. So it felt really personal, you know?
Yeah. Pre-email rejections, right?
Yeah. And so what happens is I'm on these job boards, and then one day I don't even know why, but I went on monster.com.
I remember Monster. Yeah.
And I was like, surely they don't have any city manager jobs on here, but I'm going to look. And there happened to be one posted, and it was El Dorado, Texas. I applied through it. Of course, I think it was on some other job boards eventually, but I actually found it on Monster.
That's awesome.
And ended up getting a call, drove out there almost 10 hours from my home.
And this is a small town where they were. I got to ask, this is a small town, right? So were they reimbursing you for your travel expenses, or was this just like, hey, I have my own gas, my own car, I'm driving out, and it's, you know, a round trip deal? What's going on?
They were. I'll tell you what, for a small town, I can say nothing but pouring blessings that El Dorado was my first city, because they treated me extremely graciously. They it wasn't even a question. They're like, of course we're gonna reimburse your expenses.
That's awesome.
You know, we wouldn't have it any other way. My entire time being there was outstanding. And I would say is that it's the only time in executive session that when I was letting council know that I was going to be leaving, it was the only time I've ever gotten emotional and cried when it was time to say goodbye.
Oh man, that's awesome. It was your first.
It was the first.
We all remember our first, right?
Absolutely. And we had been through a lot. We'd been through a lot in El Dorado. We could probably sit and talk for 2 hours just about El Dorado, because at that time we had just had the seizure of the YFZ ranch, you know, the polygamous.
Oh, I'm not familiar with that story. Okay.
Yeah. So Warren Jeffs.
I know him. Okay. He had a ranch. Oh, I know Warren Jeffs. I know he had a ranch there. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. That's where the YFZ ranch, where he was headquartered was right outside of town. So I got there right after they got the children and the women out of there, but they still had some holdouts and they weren't paying their taxes. So the state of Texas did a tax seizure on site. They had a full municipal water and sewer system, and it had to be maintained even though nobody was there anymore. So our staff were the ones that maintained the water and sewer systems through that time period. I got to see the vineyards that they had on site, been in all the buildings. Sheriff David Dorn was very gracious to me and allowed me on the site, you know, made sure he protected me during that whole time. And it was a very interesting time. And then right after that, we were approached by trainers of the special forces and to actually do an exercise that ended up being known as Jade Helm 15. I don't know how familiar with that you are.
I'm not at all.
So we had an airdrop of, I believe it was Army Rangers. I'm not certain anymore. But anyway, they were airdropped and they told all the jurisdictions from north of Amarillo to Schleicher County, which is where El Dorado is, and told them, this is when the Rangers will be in your jurisdiction. Try to catch them if you can. And their landing spot was the YFZ ranch, and they did all of their trainings on site. So after they had kind of done their not to be detected from Amarillo down.
This conversation went sideways. Wait, so we government training program, a military training program, and they're saying, hey, we're airdropping these special forces, and we want you guys to go out and try to get them?
Yeah, they told all the jurisdictions. Well, they didn't say like go get them, but they're like,
in Texas.
Well, you should look it up, because it was very interesting. Because since we were like the last bastion of kind of like that Western exercise,
yeah,
there was also another exercise in Central Texas as well. You know, Governor Abbott activated the State Guard because there was like this kind of theory that President Obama was using this as the official overthrow of the government. So he was like, Abbott like activated the State Guard, and they were like going out. Their main presence was in Bastrop, Texas. And
really?
And so we were like, you know, at least on my end of things, I was like, I would have never dreamt. I say all of that, you know, I say all these things and you should really, you know, check into it. It's really interesting for a town of 1,800 people in the middle of really nowhere, about 45 minutes south of San Angelo, 3 hours from Austin, went, you know, learned a lot of hands-on experience and some very unique experiences. So I loved my 3 years there.
That is amazing. What man, there's a lot to unpack. We're going to have you on maybe for multiple episodes or something, Theo.
It was fun. I loved it.
Or turn this into a Joe Rogan 3-hour marathon. Maybe, I don't know. Are you down? We'll see. I don't know.
You know, Joe is a fantastic interviewer.
Speaking of Austin, right?
Yeah, speaking of, man.
So Theo, you just mentioned San Angelo. A recent episode, I had John Barrio on. I don't know if you're familiar with this or not, but he's doing a recall of his entire city council over what he believes is the mayor's attempt to subvert or usurp the power of the city manager. Are you aware of that at all?
I had read the article kind of right before you had posted it on social media. And so I actually listened to the episode.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah, just that was completely unexpected, a little call out there. So you were in El Dorado, and it's funny because in Kansas, I learned that too. We have, and I think I talked about in a previous episode early on in the podcast series, but when I moved to Kansas, there's an El Dorado, Kansas as well. And you don't call it El Dorado because otherwise they know. And then the other funny thing is we have the Arkansas River in Kansas. It's spelled Arkansas, but you pronounce it Arkansas.
So, well, that's how they weed you out.
That's how they weed you out for sure. Exactly. Yeah. Oh man. You know, Theo, you get the job. You're there for how long in El Dorado?
About 3 years.
3 years. And I was in Sedgwick, town of 1700. That was my first gig. And I was kind of it was time for me to go when I left. I knew it. And it was already planned ahead of time. And I was much, you know, further along in my life as opposed to you, because obviously that was your first job out of college. But this was my first city administrator gig. And I was, you know, it was an emotional time, but the right time for me to leave. But man, I have nothing but fond memories of my first gig. And man, we could probably have a podcast with a bunch of city managers just talking about their first time and the impact those gigs had on them, for better or for worse, right?
Sure. What I would say too is, and I've given this advice to some of the regional Texas assistance organizations. A lot of them are kind of buried in the depth chart, if you will, yep, in larger organizations. And I've been a strong proponent for getting out to these small towns. One, they need your expertise and they're having trouble getting them. They're great opportunities. I would tell you is that the nicest, most awesome people I've worked for, just coolest people were the people in El Dorado and Schleicher County as a whole. They were just really gracious. And you know, I love the pace. And sometimes you never know, you may get hooked on that and never want to leave it, you know, and that's my advice.
Absolutely, Theo. I talk about this quite a bit. As you know, I firmly believe that why be a big time or big town, big city management analyst or whatnot, when you can jump out of that organization, go get the title in a small town, you're going to get exposed to things that you would never get exposed to as a management analyst in a large organization. You're not going to get exposed to an MPA school. The only way you get exposed to it is by hands-on, the world just throwing stuff at you, and you have to do everything in a small town. And then, you know, you put your 2-3 years in, right? You do your tour, and then you start bouncing up the food chain, right? When it comes to large organizations, and you're going to be making more money more quickly than if you'd stayed in these organizations and worked your way up. I mean, that's what I believe. So you and I are on the same page there. You know, let's turn ourselves on. So let's say you go from El Dorado and then walk us to Dickinson.
Yeah. So then I go to Gladewater, which is kind of in the Northeast Texas, kind of Tyler, Longview area, very gorgeous area, historic Main Street. So I really had my first experience working with Main Street, getting it recertified, really working on, they have a recreational lake that also serves as the water supply. So it was,
you know, Tyler Lake?
No, it's actually Lake Gladewater.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right. I was just trying to get a little shout out to my favorite band. One of my favorite bands of all time is the Toadies. They have a song called Tyler. Are you familiar with them at all?
Yeah, a little bit. Yes. Yeah, so that's kind of funny.
They're back in the mid-90s. Yeah, they didn't really blow up, unfortunately. They had a one or two good hits, but one of my favorite bands of all time. Anyway, shout out to the Toadies. So, and Tyler. So you're in Gladewater, and then what happens after that?
So, you know, I actually spent about a year and 7 months there. It was funny how you brought up the 2-year commitment thing. I really sat with the TCMA and ICMA kind of explaining the situation in Gladewater. It's a city that is it's a wonderful community. There's some great people there, but there are groups of people that really make it a habit of abusing city managers. So they, you know, the tenures vary in Gladewater, and some very interesting stories, by the way. I mean, it's a very strong history in that community. It was like the only wet city in the region, you know, like really? During the time of in the 40s, 50s and early 60s, because Texas went from dry to wet. I mean, there's still some dry counties.
There's still some dry counties, right? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But Gladewater, the city itself, you know, was really had, you know, a huge bar scene. In fact, they have all kind of pictures of Elvis Presley playing there.
How big is Gladewater?
It's only about 6,500 people, but back in the 50s, they had 56 bars.
They had 56 bars?
Yeah.
56 bars. And they didn't have 6,500 people back then.
No, I mean, it was, well, actually, surprisingly, if you look at the census, I mean, I don't know how they did it. And I've always made a joke about it, I mean, because they really were the personification. But from the 1950s to present, they have stayed at 6,500 people in every census from like 1950 to present. And the truth of the matter is, I don't know how a city can do it, but they figured out how, if you're coming in, who are you kicking out? You know?
Well, is a prerequisite is that you have to drink, maybe, I guess, right? There's no teetotalers are allowed in.
Well, it was funny because, you know, one of the first stories that I saw, I had become really good friends with the newspaper owner, you know, and he and I, Jim, he's just a really, really fascinating gentleman. And one day we're just talking, it was like really early on. He said, you know, it used to be really wild, you know, it's really calmed down now. But it never got wilder than the time that the police chief had to shoot a lion on Main Street. Apparently someone had brought a lion back in the 60s or early 70s on this bar row, and the lion wasn't cooperating with the owner, so they had to put it down.
Are the reports that the lion was drunk unconfirmed? Yeah,
it's kind of lost to the fog of history.
A lion on Main Street, huh?
Yeah, so it was pretty fun. Man. So it was a great town, but I explained some situations I was having there with certain people, and so
let's unpack that if you don't mind, because I have some thoughts on that 2-year rule as I just recently posted on LinkedIn and what have you. And why don't you unpack that for us if you don't mind sharing some details, because I think this is a very interesting topic and not one that we were planning on talking about again. But you know, I have problems with the idea that it's an ethical issue if a city manager stays less than 2 years somewhere, especially in the climate that we're operating in now. The environment's gotten incredibly divisive, political, nasty. You throw in the social media element. There's just a lot of reasons why I think the 2-year rule is an archaic relic that probably should be done away with. Not probably, I think it should be done away with. And I don't like the idea, by the way, that a city manager somehow has to treat an ICMA ethics staffer like it's their priest and share sensitive personal information if that's part of the component for wanting to leave a position after, you know, within the 2-year mark. Why don't you walk us through a little bit of what your experience was and how you navigate those waters? Because I've never been in that situation, having never been an ICMA member.
Well, and truth be told, is it's also part of the state board as well. And so, you know, I reached out to my ICMA rep, regional rep at the time. I reached out to TCMA regional rep. To sum up my philosophy on it is that I think that there it is problematic, especially in the world we live in, where the politics can be brutal, you know, in certain cities. And it's actually doing a bit of a disservice maybe to some of those cities, because if you know you have to be in a city for 2 years without, you know, some type of retribution, then I think there are certain cities that have had these long reputations of treating city managers certain ways. They just won't get quality candidates if they know I have to commit to 2 years here. That may be daunting. And so I tend to agree that maybe it's time to relook at it because of the real realities of what's going on in some of these communities. My specific, you know, situation was very early on in my tenure. There was a Main Street project where they were doing some ornate lighting, and this lighting was very expensive. And there was a store owner in town linked up with a council member as a part of that. And when I started asking questions, along with another project dealing with the building of our baseball and softball park, within 3 weeks of being there, I was like, hey, we have some issues here. Those two things tied together because it kind of dealt with the same set of people. Uh-huh. And when I started bringing those things up, I sent an email to the council saying, hey, guys, because I didn't know the council member was involved in it. Like at this point, I was just like, hey, there's a problem with these vendors. Mm-hmm. And so I sent that email. And then the email that came back came from that one council member dressing me down, just like I was a dog, you know, saying, how dare you question any of this, even though I'm asking the store, give me some invoices, show me that is the cost of these lights.
Basic city manager 101, right? I mean, just doing your due diligence on behalf of the taxpayers, obviously nothing crazy, and you're getting massive blowback just on that.
Yeah. And so, you know, and so, I mean, there were other behaviors. So like I was not there. Like I said, I was there for 17, 18 months, whatever it was. And I was, my job So the problem was that council member and the mayor were friends. So okay. The mayor has the ability to put anything on the agenda. So immediately I went from a 7-0 to a 5-2 within weeks when I uh-huh. started asking those questions. Then for the, you know, I would say my last 13 or 14 months there, my job was put on the line 9 of those 13 months.
You mean there's an actual agenda item to discuss your employment?
Yes.
That's ridiculous.
And so exactly. That's why TCM, I mean, now, you know, we can argue the merits of, you know, should you have to, but you know, I want, right. if I'm operating under the rules, I'm going to be a rule follower.
And yeah. And you're still young in your career. I mean, that's mm-hmm. only your second gig. I mean, you still got to do well. I mean, just because you do well in your first gig, you still kind of got to do well in that second gig before you can really kind of feel like you got your legs under you and maybe feel like you're can withstand maybe a bad experience, right? So
sure.
So you go to the TCMA, and what do they say?
I mean,
did you go to the ICMA first? Or I don't know how that works.
I actually did. I did TCMA and first, and then I went to ICMA. I mean, I'll say this is like TCMA and ICMA. I don't think there's like a ton of coordinating between the two. So if you're a member, I'm a member of both, still am. But my point being is like, you know, because I went and talked to TCMA that you can expect, or vice versa, that I don't necessarily know if they communicate with each other.
Gotcha.
And so I wanted to make sure I started at TCMA because that's my state board. When it came to, you know, hearing from them, you know, talked with ICMA, and once I got rent, you know, it was not a hard sell when I started explaining like the real details, like getting down into the granular level. I actually had one person say, "You need to get the heck out of there."
So for the managers who are not part of the ICMA, or for those who are but have never gone through the situation, do they give you the full sign off and blessing and say, "Hey, yeah, you have our blessing, you can leave," or do they say, "Hey, we understand your situation, and if someone files a complaint against you, then we will go to bat for you"? How does that walk us through that dynamic? If you don't, because I don't even know how that works.
It was relatively informal. I mean, no one said, you know, "You've been blessed, my son," you know, or anything like
okay.
that. It was really more like we understand why you're doing it. I mean, it doesn't stop somebody from filing
a complaint
against
you,
know, but we understand your situation. And it sounds to us like you have a good case, basically.
Okay. And then, you took it as a blessing, even though it wasn't a direct or explicit one, essentially.
Well, I'll be honest with you. I mean, I was at a point there that it didn't matter either way. Yeah, it didn't really matter. But I had the receipts. So I mean, basically the answer was, hey, if you get a complaint and you can show all the stuff you just told us, you know, you got it.
Gotcha. Okay. So you eject out of there, and then walk us through your next step.
Oh, so I mean, next up, I go to Dayton, Texas, which is right outside of the Houston area. And some of it, too, understand, too. I mean, I've been born in South Louisiana, grew up in Louisiana, grew up on a farm. I was literally the opposite of a city manager. I was stacking hay.
You're a farm manager.
yeah, pretty much. Yeah, exactly. The only city management I had done at that point was Sim City, you know, until I left Louisiana. My father's older. Still with us, but older, much older than I am. I'm kind of like almost a whole generation. I'm a two generations from my dad. He grew up in the Great Depression, and I was born in 1984.
It
tells you something, right? So
it definitely tells me something.
Yeah, no doubt. Upbringing was quite unusual. I didn't see it there.
Old man's got some stamina.
Apparently. More than I've got. But I moved to West Texas. I moved to Northeast Texas. I'm really far from home. I got to start being closer to him as he's getting older.
Right.
So Dayton was perfect. I'm looking for an opportunity closer to home. This opportunity right outside of Houston. I'm from South Louisiana. It's right down Interstate 10. This is great. So I go there. Dayton's about 7,800 people, but they're in a unique situation. The growth pattern of Houston is gone in every direction except Northeast, which is where Dayton is. So a lot of my work was annexation, master plans, strategic plans, building for the future, doing the development agreements with future large developments, you know, the largest one being, you know, working with River Ranch. We've had a couple of other ones too, but River Ranch was about a 7,200 acre master plan residential development. And then we had about a 1,050 acre rail served industrial park that we negotiated an agreement with. So really that work was really fun. But the thing I guess the best way to put it, and I don't know, not everybody would go with the route I took. I love Dayton, still love Dayton to this day. But a lot of the growth in Dayton isn't coming for another 20 years.
Okay.
And at that point, I'm 30, right? At that point when I'm deciding on if I'm going to Dickinson or not, I was about 36.
You want some action, right? You're all about that action, boss, right?
Yeah. So it's like, yeah, I mean, so like really the big action wouldn't be coming to Dayton until I'm in my early 50s.
I get it. Yeah.
And so I had to make some decisions. I love the community. It's almost like if I were at my age and 15 years from now, I probably would have retired in Dayton. Dickinson, on the other hand, is a landlocked community. It's halfway between Houston and Galveston. Beautiful community, 21,000 people. It's about 10 square miles with 7 miles of bayou running right down the middle of the town. So a lot of waterfront. They've never really had a lot of professional services, really. Stunning in some ways that you know, it incorporated late around 1977. Considering it was in the middle of a metro, it actually incorporated to survive being gobbled up by its neighbors.
So it usually happens, right? In those urban areas. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was brought in. They're like, listen, you know, we have not very good customer service. We really want to have better service to the community. Our infrastructure is a wreck post Harvey. 90% of the city was underwater during Harvey. Also, there's really no master planning for the community. That, you know, the zoning code hadn't been looked at in 21 years at that point. And it was,
which is far, far too long for an area for to be in that area. Right. That's just way too.
The characteristics changed a lot over that time from when the zoning code was adopted in the year 2000. And when I got there in 2021, so it was a community that was really far behind. I would also say there was really nothing automated at all in the community. Everything was still very paper-based. And we lost a lot of, honestly, we lost a ton of records in Harvey.
In the hurricane? Yeah.
So, I mean, a lot of the historical knowledge was lost with that terrible tragedy. So, you know, it was unique. I felt for Dickinson, especially knowing that, you know, the predecessor had, had been, arrested, eventually charges dropped, about a year later. But at that time, it was ongoing.
It was the cloud hanging over the community, right, with that whole situation.
Yeah. Cloud hanging over the community. The Texas Rangers had showed up based on some allegations.
Not the baseball team. Not the baseball team, right?
Unfortunately not. But as an Astros fan, it would have been pretty nice to, maybe have a little pickup game. But, the Rangers had showed up because there was some thoughts of some financial impropriety. So, and I knew that going into the job.
Yeah. You didn't get blindsided with it. Yeah.
You even got calls from city man. I got calls from multiple city managers from Region 6, not saying not to do it, but they were like, it was more like you do know, right?
Right. Yeah. You're going in eyes wide open, right? You know what you're getting yourself into here, right? Yeah.
Right. So, it was, and there's some things that we're still working through even to this day from that time period, and we're still moving forward. But so I walked into a city that was golden opportunity. It's right by Galveston. It still has natural beauty, has a beautiful tree canopy. The bayou is really a small river. I mean, it's a massive, wide river, 200, in some places, 250 feet wide.
Yeah.
That's not really a bayou, but it's short. It's only 27 miles total. So it kind of falls under a bayou instead of a river. A lot of challenges, a lot of flood mitigation projects. It was just really cool because the thing I was looking for was I want to do stuff right now. And this city needed something like yesterday.
Right now. Yeah, for sure. This is an interesting thing because I was actually talking to an aspiring city manager via LinkedIn message within the last couple of days. And I told this individual on LinkedIn about how one piece of advice, unsolicited advice, is you are never going to feel like you're ready probably to be a city manager. You're always going to feel like you're don't know something or you're in over your head or what have you. And that's just going to be par for the course, right? When you left Gladewater, to go to Dayton, and then you left Dayton to go to Dickinson. Did you feel like you were getting in over your head, especially when you went made that jump from Dayton to Dickinson? Did you feel like you were kind of in over your head a little bit, or?
No, I think. Well, you know, I don't disagree that, hey, you know, sometimes you really need to know your limitations. I mean, you know, let me just throw that out there.
And obviously this is your third, this had been what, your fourth stop, essentially. Mm-hmm. So you, I mean, you're a seasoned veteran, but you know, you're going into a whole different environment.
Right. So, you know, what I would say is that I took the mentality of this, and, you know, cause I know we're going to be, you know, the main topic of what we're talking about is doing what needs to be done. I mean, you know, if we're talking about the big umbrella, right?
Yeah.
You know, what I came to realize in Gladewater, especially as I kept going into executive session after executive session, is something that stuck with me through now, is I may not be there very long, but I want to be able to say that during the time I was there, that the people paid for the government they deserve.
Right.
And unfortunately, you know, I'm not here to cast aspersions, because actually I have been blessed that oftentimes the person I came after, there was a team there. There was, you know, there were some things in place working or whatever. But I would say is that I do think that sometimes for the sake of job security, things have been overlooked that should not have been overlooked. And truth be told is I try to do my very best, at least during the time I'm somewhere, to try to tie up the loose ends as much as I can so that the next person doesn't have to work on the things I worked on. You know, to try to make the community better. They're not worrying about fixing the foundation. They're talking about framing up for the house now. I would make an argument that every city I've worked for, I worked on the foundation. And that's me okay.
Too. Yeah, it is. Me too. And it's tough work. It's a grind. You know, I also joke around in my communities that I was in that, you know, when I was there, it was Top Ramen and Kraft mac and cheese out of the box. And then when I left, it was more of let's go out to the steakhouse this Friday night to have dinner. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And what I would tell anybody, because kind of to circle back to the original intent of the question was, you know, like, you know, being in over your head, the challenge I would make to anybody that is making a leap, maybe jumping up, you know, a population. You know, I think at one point in time, there was kind of this rule of six, you know, I'd heard, you know, people played by as like, okay, if you're in a city of 2,000, then you can't really get a job above 12,000. You know, stuff that we talked about, probably just a conspiracy theory in the back, you know, back in a room, you know, but, you know, it's just something, but it seems to have worked for, that seems to be kind of how it works. But that being said, is that, you got to take those chances, because here's the truth of the matter is somebody has to fill these roles. We're in a labor crunch right now. I mean, city managers, it's hard. I mean, it's painful to hear about communities that deserve good leadership and deserve good people. And truth be told is sometimes I can tell you that there are people that have 35 years of experience. And then one day, and that's what I love about the profession, is I bet you that 35-year veteran is going to walk in one day and have to deal with something they never dealt with before.
And, amen.
You're right. And so it's not necessarily about having seen it all. It's about being able to understand how to respond to it, finding the resources, being humble enough to ask for help.
That's such a huge one. That's a huge one, Theo, because mm-hmm. I think we all know there's managers in this business who are afraid of looking insecure, or afraid of looking like they don't know something and being insecure of asking or whatnot, or they got to put on the airs that they know everything or that they have everything under control. And it's okay to not know something. It's okay to ask for help.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, I would say is that, I mean, if you're getting down to the brass tacks of what, you know, the camaraderie of what, why do we have the city management associations? You know, if you really think about it, it's really about knowledge, about being able to share that knowledge so that you don't have to keep reinventing the wheel in every community that you're in. And there's other things too, but I mean, baseline is to be able to say, hey, I know somebody because we were at that conference and I feel comfortable enough to ask them a question.
Yeah, I would say it's that community, that sense of connectedness, right? The sense that we're not in it alone. And I think that's one of the big common things that I hear, Theo, ever since I started posting on LinkedIn a year and a half ago and doing the podcast, is just that so many city managers feel alone. They feel like, and I've gotten so much feedback from individuals who say, you know, reading your stories on LinkedIn are so therapeutic because I know I'm not alone, that other people are dealing with the same crap in some form or fashion that I'm dealing with. It's been an interesting challenge. It's been interesting in that context in terms of interacting with people and feeling that sense of connectedness. And that's what gives me a lot of fulfillment. That's what's been paying my soul. And that's why I really enjoy what I've been doing on here.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, I tend to agree with, you know, I really feel like, you know, a lot of the, well, best way to put it is the sentiment that you feel alone. I can agree with it in many ways, because I've been relatively active historically in ICMA and TCMA, and you know I had my own, you know, issues that I dealt with in Dickinson, that personal bleeding over into the professional world, and that, you know, ended up, I definitely felt alone during some of those times as well.
Do you want to unpack that a little bit more, or do you want to veer off in that territory? Because it's a pretty serious issue.
No, I'm more than happy to talk about it. It's not a problem for me.
Okay. Why don't you unpack it for us, Theo? Because you went through a very traumatic personal event that could rock someone's to the core, to be honest, and can upend their, not only their personal life, but can also destroy their career if the ball bounces a certain way. So.
Sure. You know, on my end of things, back December 28th of 2021, there was a domestic dispute that had the police called. I had already left the house when the police had arrived, because I was in an argument with, at the time, a longtime girlfriend, and, you know, verbal words, very hurtful, to the point where, you know, there was one doorway out of the bedroom because I was packing my bag to leave, and I let baser things happen, you know, thoughts come to me, and I pushed her out of the way and left the house.
And because she was blocking your exit.
She was, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Still not an excuse, but it happened. The following day is when I found out that the previous night the police had been over and I was being placed on administrative leave. The news had broke, I don't know, maybe a couple hours after I found out. And on January 5th of 2022, I surrendered myself for, you know, I was placed in jail, booked, had to spend, I mean, look, let's just be honest. I didn't get the Oz treatment. You know, it wasn't like I dealt with that.
Right. But you sure as hell weren't getting preferential treatment just because you're the city manager. That sounds like, that's for sure.
No, and it shouldn't be. In fact, I would say that's the point. I think that's the point is that none of us are above the law. In that situation, you know, there were
push you on pause there for a second. So you were put in jail. You were booked on basically some sort of domestic violence charge, it sounds like, right?
Yes.
A post Me Too, believe all women era. So you are in the situation which, as a public facing city manager, could literally be a career ender. You must have been terrified that your career was going to be over, that you were going to get fired. I don't want to get into the details of your predecessor because they're not here to defend themselves, but they went through a similar situation. And here you are, the second city manager in the community, going through a similar kind of incident, so to speak. You must have been scared shitless, to be honest.
I was. I was, you know, in this situation, and I didn't know necessarily how to deal with it other than just to be honest. So, I basically spent my entire time like making sure that every fact of the situation, I gave them all the information that I could. That what I did wasn't right. I'm not going to sit there and say that I should have pushed her out of the way and stormed out and said the things that I said. I would say that, you know, I do think that there was another way it could have been done. I would say there was this like kind of gap in time as to why, you know, the charges were December 28th, or at least I was charged then, or, you know, that a warrant out for my arrest, and I surrendered on January 5th. And that was because I was actually I was with my dad because it was Christmas time. And so I was picking up my boys.
Holiday.
And,
yeah.
You know, taking the boys. So I was actually on my way to Louisiana when I found out about it. And so working with the sheriff's office saying, look, you know, I'll come back. I mean, I have my two young boys, things of that nature. I said, there's just some logistics. And so anyway, January 5th, all that happens. And then, you know, of course, I give my statement, you know, have my attorney dealing with all of that. You know, cooler heads had prevailed, and so in time, as this situation ends up going to the DA's office, they end up dropping it because, you know, really, you know, it's not that it's trivial. It's just that, you know, if there's no there, there, that's just, you know, what it ended up being. But I did learn a lot from that experience. What I'd say is that it really, you know, mental health is something that people, I guess, you know, you had a gentleman on from,
that's right, Kansas. Stephen Wade. Yeah. Stephen Wade, the former Topeka, Kansas manager. Yep.
Yeah, it spoke volumes. It was heart wrenching for me to listen to it because it was, you know, a lot of the talk was hitting close to home. I just couldn't, you know, to your point, you think you're alone and you're not. People are walking the path you're traveling, and you know, you all have your own. We all have our forks in the road,
right?
But we're all walking this tough path of this public persona. And the ability to try to keep your family shielded from it. You try to shield yourself from it. And sometimes you tell yourself that you're good at leaving that at work and then coming home, and then none of that's bleeding over. And I'm here to say that oftentimes isn't true. And I hope that his story, my story, what they do is they tell city managers, hey, why don't you take a minute and make sure that you're not living in a fantasy world. Are you sure you're not taking that home? Are you sure you're not weighing down your spouse, your children, your significant others, like siblings and so forth? Are you sure about that? Take stock. Right.
Yeah, it's a good point, Theo, because I tend to pride myself on my ability to compartmentalize. And that has a lot to do with the childhood molestation and issues I went through having drug addicts or parents and what have you. So as a survival mechanism, you're really good at learning to compartmentalize in order to function and get through day-to-day life. But I noticed that as I've gotten older, I think I'm losing my ability to compartmentalize. It's my skills have kind of softened a little bit. And you know, I've gone through some stresses at work and had it bleed over, and it was an eye opener. And I talked about that a little bit. I think I talked about that in the Stephen Wade interview. I'm not sure, but I used to pride myself on being able to compartmentalize and be impervious to stress and what have you. And I've learned that, you know, I'm not as impervious to stress as I thought I was. And it's been definitely a learning experience for me. You know, before we move on to this conversation's really gone a completely different direction than I was expecting, Theo, but I want to unpack this a little bit more because if you don't mind, because this is a really serious deal. There's a lot of aspects to this. You know, there's a city manager right now. I don't even want to name the name or whatnot. He's been in the news for the last several weeks because he ironically enough had a domestic incident with his two adult daughters over the Christmas New Year's break. And that's resulted in a lot of public issues as far as whether or not there's preferential treatment and releasing of videotape or releasing of the officer, you know, body cameras and so forth and so on. And, you know, we live in a society now where there's always a rush to judgment. It seems to be the case when it comes to if you're charged with something, you must be guilty, right? Or something like that. And you go back into the whole thing with the, you know, believe all women and Me Too. And, you know, if someone is accusing you of doing something, then therefore it must be true. Can you walk us back a little bit more through how you navigated this process with your governing body, especially in light of the fact that the governing body, I don't know if it's the same members or not, but obviously that governing body as a body had some previous issues or dealings with the predecessor who had some similar circumstances. They must have been a little bit weary and gun shy and concerned. Walk for the betterment of our peers. Can you walk us through how you handled and navigated that relationship with your governing body in order for them to maintain that confidence and faith and trust in you and give you that shot, I guess, to stick it out? Because they could have cut bait on you easily.
Sure. I mean, I think that first, I'm thankful for the council for giving me that opportunity to redeem myself, you know, in some ways, you know. I was hired on a 5-2. When I got to Dickinson, I was put on administrative leave with a 7-0, obviously. And I was actually reinstated with a 5-2, which was the same 5-2 for the hiring and firing decision. So,
sorry, I don't mean to laugh, but I mean, okay, at least they're consistent, I guess, right? So
I give them that.
Yeah.
But So what I would say is that they put me on leave. They instantly begin an internal affairs investigation. So they're kind of like, hey, we're having to make a decision on what we're going to do with this guy. And, you know, they can't wait for the justice system. You know, that's going to take months and months and months.
Yep.
And so what they basically do is they kind of do their own investigation, kind of looking at all the facts, talk to all the parties, the statements and so forth, and got statements. And a lot of those facts ended up at the DA's office later, which actually contributed to the dismissal. Not that it was shared by the city to them. It's just that when the DA's office did their full-on investigation, they ended up finding the same things. And basically, if you're asking, like, why, you know, yes, they were leery, then as they should be. We just went through this a little over a year ago, and here we are again. Facts were a little different. Also, you know, truth be told is that a lot of my situation was very, and it's not to belittle it, but there are degrees of what happens, you know, in a domestic violence situation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And
mine, like, just even, just straight up was like this, you know, at best would have been considered like what we call almost a class D. It was basically on the level of a speeding ticket in the first place. And so, you know, that would have been like kind of like, okay, well, the degree of it. And, you know, at that point, you know, that is not what my predecessor was dealing with. My predecessor was dealing with something
a little bit more egregious, a little bit more serious, and involving children.
Yes, absolutely. So, yeah.
Or a child. I forget the exact details, but yeah.
Sure. So, you know, there were some like issues of degree.
I should say a minor. I don't know if it was a child or not, but again, it was a little bit of a different circumstance for sure. But still, the same family tree, so to speak, if that makes sense. But
sure, and you know, so I think one thing was the issue of degree. I'd also say, look, you know, I came in with hat in hand, saying this is exactly what happened. This is exactly what happened, and I'm
well. That's kind of what I wanted to unpack when I talk about getting to a little bit of a granular level, Theo, because this is such a very unique situation. So, what was your first outreach? Did you call the mayor? Did you call individual members of the council? Did you send an email to everybody? Because obviously, when you're notified that you are being charged or they want you to come in and be booked, you're out of state visiting family on this holiday. So you had some time to communicate with them. I'm assuming that they didn't communicate with the governing body first and then notify you that, as far as law enforcement. So I'm assuming you had the ability to contact your governing body before the law enforcement got it out into the public domain. Maybe, I don't know. Can you walk us through that?
I believe it or not, I was the last one to find out in the scheme of things.
Are you serious? Oh, yeah, wow.
Yeah, it was some, you know, to this day, don't know how, but some council members were like directly contacted and said, he doesn't know yet, basically, but he's about to be informed that.
Oh, you know, it's interesting because, you know, going back to that Stephen Wade interview, when we talked about mental health, he talked about the fact that, you know, when you're the city manager and you live in the community and whatnot, that you're not anonymous, right? You're not even able to be treated like a normal person in a sense. So you are actually getting less than the sort of fair treatment that the other residents might get or other citizens. So in his instance, he talked about how he couldn't even get help for his health issues, mental health issues, because he was afraid that individuals in the community would be aware of his situation. So in here, you had you living in Dickinson, I assume. This is evolving. Yes. Dickinson Police Department, which obviously you oversee the department, which there's another layer, because now we're getting to another layer of the whole original train of thought with respect to this interview was their police chief, obviously, right? You have this issue that comes up later on. What are your thoughts when you find out that you're the last person to know?
Well, you know, it was very emotional. I'll probably never forget that, you know, you ever have these moments in your life where you can remember every detail of every color. Yeah. I have stories that are black and white and they're kind of hazy. The memory of getting the phone call that, you know, hey, you know, last night the police were at your house and they took statements and you're going to, there's a warrant out for your arrest. You know,
that's not something every city manager has the privilege of hearing in their career. A warrant out for your arrest.
Yeah. And so, you know, it was one of those situations where like in that moment, it's like time stood still. And it's like, I was taking in every detail of of it, you know? And so, you know, it was disheartening to be the last to know. I would say that, you know, because it is a unique situation. It wasn't like, I mean, obviously I would have been the first to know if I were still at the house and the whole thing had been happening while I was there, but right. I had left. I was out. I had actually...
No clue. It ain't like she called you after the fact and said, hey, by the way, I called the cops on you.
No, never, never at any point in time. And, you know, I had stayed the night at a hotel that night because that's, you know, because I was like, look, you know, I need to separate myself from this whole situation. I'm leaving the house. And
well, and what's the drive time from Dickinson to home?
It's about
back to Louisiana, I mean, in that context.
About 3 hours. About
yeah.
Three
okay. Hours. All right. Yeah.
It was actually that next day when I on the drive there that I found out.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, earlier we talked about how city managers shouldn't be given preferential treatment. But in this case, you were given less than equal treatment, right? Because most people are the first to know when they get arrested or they're going to be arrested, right? Not the last to know in this situation.
Right, right. In fact, you know, that's what I was told was that, you know, pretty much everyone already knows, you know, you don't need to be contacting counsel at this point because you're about to be put on administrative leave. And, you know, I kind of understand why they took the tack they did.
That because try to cut you off. Well, I'm going to speculate here, right? Because we haven't talked about this. Because a lot of this whole first asking conversations pretty much has been kind of an impromptu thing here. But I'm going to speculate that this was a coordinated hit. I'm speculating. I could be completely out of line here, but I feel like this was a coordinated hit and attempt to put you at a severe disadvantage when it comes to defending yourself and protecting your career. Because this whole idea that everyone already knows, so you don't need to talk to the council, that's absolute horseshit. You know what I mean? It's like, no, I'm going to talk to the council and basically explain what happened and how I'm basically being victimized here.
Sure.
And by the way, Theo, I guess that's probably a good time for me to interject in because earlier you said something to the effect of, you know, I pushed her to the side and I shouldn't have done it and whatever. You know, I at the risk of getting canceled by the Me Too Believe All Women cohort who listen to the podcast, you know, when I was a young man with the mother of my kids, I got into a very identical situation from based on what you described. We were in our master bedroom. And we were having an argument. I always just wanted to get out of the house and just leave me alone. And she blocked my path. She wouldn't let me go. She had my keys. She would block my path. And it was just a repeated deal. And it's just like, no, you're not going to block me in and keep me somewhere against my will. I have a right to defend myself. I have a right to protect myself. Now, I didn't punch her. I didn't hit her or anything like that. But there was a physical altercation of me getting out of that bedroom. So no, I don't think you were out of line at all, in my opinion. I'm just going to put that out there as someone who's been in a very similar situation. A woman does not have the right to keep a man somewhere against his will just because she wants to talk it out. You know what I mean? But that's just a little bit of my editorializing. So you have the situation now, and are you able to talk to your counsel, your allies on the council, and give them, you know, is this before you get booked or walk me through that timeline?
You know, what ends up happening is that, you know, I do end up talking with a couple of the council members just to kind of let them know, hey, this is what happened. You know, like, let me explain. Which was good because when they went in to do an investigation and they talked with at the time and myself, you know, what was kind of weird to this day, really can't fully put my finger on exactly how the narrative started this way, but the council was under the impression that I had, and even the sheriff's office who ended up taking it, because, you know, it got kicked out to a third party agency because obviously I'm the city manager.
Yeah.
Somehow the narrative had started that I had actually grabbed her by the throat and choked her. And that
was much more serious.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's not good. And I would never condone something like that. Well, that's not what happened. I mean, and what's crazy is as my attorney started getting into the statements and looking into all the evidence of the sheriff's office, you know, once all these, you know, investigations are done, that was never even said at any point in time, but somehow a narrative said that I choked her and was like, and like, you know, cause you know, there's this class, cause you know, there's a class A misdemeanor of, you know, you're restricting airflow.
Okay. Right? Serious.
So serious. Yeah. I pushed her and that's like, you know, you're talking about class A misdemeanor it's essentially a class D. It's not called a class D. It's basically a parking ticket, not a parking ticket, but a speed
yeah.
level offense. Those are two. That's a big gap.
But again, Theo, I will editorialize. It ain't a misdemeanor, in my opinion, if you are defending yourself or trying to get out of a situation where you're being held against your will. So I just put that out there again.
Sure.
So.
Well, and I would also say it's like, if I'm grabbing someone's throat and choking them, that might blur the line a little bit. But I guess my point being is that never even happened. And
right.
somehow that story, even the council at some point in time had gotten wind of this story. The sheriff's office charged me with it. Then, as we're going along with it, it's like, wait a minute, that's not even what it is. It's if you're even going to go for anything, if it's a push, it's this class D thing.
That's scary stuff. That's scary stuff to be accused of doing something like that.
And, I would never do that. But my point being is that the independent investigation happens, internal affairs finds none of that. The sheriff's office investigation, none of that. So when the DA gets it, DA's office does what they do. They have their own investigatory team and they do their own thing. They talk to people and all that stuff to try to get information. And it's like, none of the facts of the case lend to what was being circulated as the original story to counsel.
So what's the timeline on how this is going down as far as between the time that you get booked and into jail versus this whole matter being dropped? I mean, because this didn't just happen overnight and you're still in a state of limbo for a while, I would imagine.
Yeah. So I was pretty much in limbo from December 28th till around January 11th. So I had
it actually got cleared up pretty quick for you then.
Yeah, what I'm going to say is that first of all, the council did a very smart move, and that was to go ahead and do their own internal affairs investigation. They found their findings, pretty much finding that the original statements of both myself and my at the time girlfriend were very similar, but also didn't have any of this choking stuff.
Right, right, right.
That was somehow getting circulated. And once they kind of got to that conclusion on all sides and some other considerations, they talked, we had some good discussions as to, what the future holds, but really everything happened in about a 2-week period of time. And they were able to do that because they took the time and said, you know what, we have a law firm that has the investigatory capabilities of getting to the bottom of it. And you know what, if he's lying or some of this stuff is true, and it's egregious or whatever their factor would have been, but they did get that kind of investigation internally done. And I was reinstated about 2 weeks after the initial incident.
So when you were put on, I assume it was paid leave, right? You said paid leave?
Yes, it was paid leave.
So when you're on paid leave, were you forbidden or prohibited from talking to anybody or members of the council at that point or time? Or was there any ground rules that were set? I'm just out of curiosity. I mean, it's just curious how this played out. Or did you call any conversation like that?
Yeah, I mean, there was that. I mean, look, their business still had to run in the city. So, I let them know. So basically, it was there were two people. It was my assistant city manager and the mayor. Those were the kind of the contacts. If they needed me, they contact me. It's not the other way around. And really, it was really to talk about projects. I mean, I had just gotten, I mean, that's the other part of this story is I hadn't.
You don't have any built up goodwill. Yeah, you haven't built up this reservoir of goodwill by being there for an extended period of time. They still don't really even know who you are as a person.
Right, absolutely. And at this moment, they don't know what they're dealing with exactly. But during that 2-week period, I had two contacts, two people to contact with, and so if there were any questions about policy or operations, hey, you signed this document, who does this need to be forwarded to, and all that stuff, and all that, I didn't really need my help a ton, but that was kind of how that worked out. And that was the ground rule set for me during that administrative leave.
If you don't mind my asking, how did the social media chatter, what was the climate of that in your community during this period of time? Because obviously it became news and seemingly in every community, but I'm exaggerating, but the social media climate can be really toxic, really, really bitter, really divisive. I mean, it could be just a feeding frenzy on city managers and elected officials when there's bad news. How was that? And how did you handle it? Did you even read it? Did you just completely disengage? I'm just kind of curious how you handled that whole part of the equation.
That was a very complex situation because up until that point, I I had never really, I mean, first of all, I never dealt with that this type of situation ever before. But then having this social media side of it really was interesting. I would say that I disengaged from it a lot. Didn't really read it, because truth be told is no one knew the truth but me and my ex-girlfriend at the time. And you know, everyone else is speculating. And so, I mean, look, here's the truth. I mean, the speculation was all over the place. I mean, it wasn't just like anti-me. Some of it was like, you know, she probably did it to herself or something, you know, and I don't necessarily agree with that either.
Right.
You know, most of these situations are more complex than it's his fault or it's her fault. It's usually right.
Shades of gray, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So you saw the gamut of everything, and people had all these wild speculations of what happened. So, I mean, really, most of it was a lot of armchair quarterbacking. So, I mean, I didn't need to hear the theories, because I knew what happened, and she knew what happened. And really, it was interesting. I'll say this too, is one of the things that really changed the course of a lot of the dialogue was, at one point, the Galveston County Daily News reported on a letter that my ex sent to the council to let them know that, kind of like, this is what happened, basically. This is what happened, not
right.
this other thing. And what was interesting was kind of in it, and what Galveston County Daily News latched onto was, you know, she kind of called out what you talked about. She brought up that this was kind of I think she actually used the term like a witch hunt, because okay. He's a city manager, and kind of was like, this would not have happened if he were
a regular Joe Schmo. Yeah.
And so that's, I think that's even what the headline is in that newspaper article, you know, because I mean, some of the stuff, to your point, the social media was like stirred up. Somehow this choking narrative got involved, that there was a restriction of airflow and all this other stuff. And that was never, ever the case. I mean, there was never a documented statement of that sort that I know of. Let me just put it that way. So to answer your question a little bit, is that reading social media was tough, and I just kind of gave up on it, mainly because I knew that my main focus had to be, henceforth, if I was going to be reinstated, wasn't going to be to sit there and read Facebook. My job from henceforth is to make sure that I'm doing the best job I can for a council that gave me this second chance at life, if you will.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I have two more lines of questioning, I guess, I kind of want to go down, and maybe I'll get into a third. I don't know, Theo, because this is a fascinating story. And I got to tell you, man, it's very courageous of you to be willing to share this publicly, because obviously most city managers don't go through something like this. And if they did go through something like this, they're not going to want to talk about it, because obviously even just talking about it, it just, people are going to take it in a negative way in some quarters, you know? So I appreciate you being willing to share your thoughts on this and your experience. It's a very unique one. Earlier, you kind of alluded to the fact that you were kind of an open book and talking about what happened, I guess, with authorities or whatnot. Did you ever hire a criminal attorney, and did you ever consider not talking to the sheriff's department or law enforcement officers about what happened, for at risk of it being turned against you? And everyone says, hey, you know, when it comes to a criminal defense situation, take the fifth, don't talk to the law enforcement, and only bad things can happen. What was your mindset on that? And can you walk us through that whole element of this equation?
Well, I mean, I hired an attorney. I mean, I don't think that there, you know, at first I wasn't sure if I would, you know, it was kind of like trying to weigh it out. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, it was a no-brainer when you really start factoring it in. I mean, you have to make sure you're preserving your rights.
Right.
And so a lot of people say, look, you know, and, you know, a lot of people were saying, well, because he hired an attorney, therefore he must have done it. Now, that's just not true. I mean, that's just not. That's not the criminal justice.
That's naive, ignorant thinking. Yeah. So did you actually talk to, when you, were you actually asked questions by law enforcement, and did you actually give them your story? Or, because you talked about sharing what happened with your council members, and were you afraid of that being used against you somehow? Or I walk me through that narrative, because it's a really difficult situation as a city manager when you know the truth is here and you want to defend yourself, but you're also afraid that things might be used against you or twisted in a legal standpoint when you're fighting for your possibly your freedom. I don't want to be too extreme on this because I don't think this is going to amount to a jail time offense in terms of prison time or jail time, but walk me through that. Walk me through that dynamic.
It was very interesting. So, you know, I had to take a couple of days to kind of decide, you know, do you get an attorney and so forth. And when I decided to get one, you know, I'd actually talked a couple of times with the investigator. And the investigator, and very gracious enough, gave me the time to get my family affairs in order in Louisiana so that I could then come back to Texas
right.
to surrender. But actually, truth be told is actually I misspoke on the timeline for one thing. There was no warrant out for my a warrant had not been put out for my arrest yet. I was just, that the call was
Got
sent
you.
To me saying that
if you don't surrender, yeah, okay. But if you didn't surrender.
Hey, just letting you know, there's an open investigation. It's being sent to the sheriff's office. So let me back up. The arrest warrant came out because what happened was I was like, okay, I'd like to talk with you and get your side of story. And I said, well, look, I got some affairs in Louisiana. I said, I can get back. And so we kind of agreed on January 5th for that to happen, that we'll go sit and talk about it. And I appreciated that time. What happened in the meantime was, you know, I hired an attorney on January 5th. I'm actually driving back. I dropped the kids off to their mother. And I'll never forget it because I was actually like dropping the kids off, leaving her house. And I get a call from my attorney and he says, I don't know what just happened, but we went from you giving them a statement. And as soon as I let them know that you're being represented by an attorney, they just went ahead and issued a warrant for your arrest, like right now.
Go really?
Surrender yourself. Yes. Which I think that was interesting. So, I mean, there's only a couple of answers to that. I don't know what they could be. Could it be that they always intended to arrest me and they wanted to perp walk me, you know, and really get that good picture? And then when they knew I had an attorney, that perp walk wasn't going to happen because my attorney was going to issue a statement to them. You know, basically, I was going to give my side of the story. Here's a written statement of what happened. And as soon as they weren't going to get that perp walk opportunity, I don't know. But all of a sudden, as soon as he represented and said, hey, I'm his attorney and we'll be turning in a written statement of the events, I had an arrest warrant issued. And so I turned myself in by the next morning at that point.
Yeah.
Because what it was, so I had dropped the kids off because I was told at 3 p.m. So noon the next day, I had surrendered myself to the Galveston County Jail.
Interesting. That's fascinating. So one other angle I wanted to talk about is what kind of response or reaction did you get from your peers? You know, I talked to a lot of our peers on background as far as, you know, LinkedIn message and emails, not related to cases like this, but related to terminations and so forth. And a lot of our peers will talk about how they feel a sense of loneliness or abandonment when they get fired or what have you. There's almost like they feel like they're a leper. They don't hear from their peers. And I'm not trying to dog every one of our peers or anything like that. This is just the feedback I get, that the sense of abandonment and just sort of like you're a leper. What kind of interaction did you get from your peers? Earlier you talked about being heavily involved in TCMA, ICMA, so forth and so on. You're still a member. I'm kind of curious to see what that network, how it helped you or not in this process.
You know, to be honest, I had a couple of people reach out to check on me, kind of nobody during the time of my 2 weeks of being on leave. I would say probably about 2 to 3 months after I had been reinstated. I had, you know, a couple check on me and ask, hey, how, you know, are you okay? I would say that truth be told is that, you know, this type of charge and this type of headline that you're in, you know, I would say that generally speaking, I don't think most of the peer group would really want to associate with somebody with that type of baggage. For better or for worse. Maybe there's a reason for it. I mean, they're public officials of their own right. Do you really want to be in a picture with me? I don't, you know, I'm sure that's thoughts that go through their mind. But to answer the question is, you know, there wasn't a whole lot, not really anyone reaching out, like kind of personally. I mean, I was still getting the, and still do get the emails to go to like regional meetings and so forth. They didn't at least take me off the mailing list, thankfully. But you know, and no one ever made me feel uncomfortable. I'm not going to say that that ever happened, but I think it was kind of a, you know, no one went out of their way to say, hey, are you okay? Not like job wise, but are you okay as a person? Are you holding up? Not much of that. And that was a little sad for me a little bit. I would have liked to have had some of my peers reach out. But I do kind of, I can understand why, you know, whether you agree with it or not, I understand why. It's just, it was a very lonely time.
But we have this justice system, right, that says that you're innocent until proven guilty. But time and time again, we see in our society that you're really not innocent until proven guilty. That's the unfortunate reality, right? At least when it comes to these personal relationships or perception or the perspective on things. And yeah, it's just interesting. I get it on one hand, right? I get it because we've all been there. We've all rushed a judgment on somebody, right, when it comes to a situation. And then when you're in a personal predicament, you kind of get to see the other perspective of things. It's probably changed your perspective on quite a few things when it comes. Maybe it has. I don't know. Has it changed your perspective or given you a different perspective on our justice system and this whole dynamic of innocent until proven guilty and so forth, since you've gone through this on such a personal level?
You know, what I'd say is that, you know, any person who would, you know, look at my situation, and if I were to sit here and be incredulous and say, well, now all of a sudden I completely understand the disservice of whatever, you know, in the criminal justice system. I just didn't have quite that experience to go through that. You know, like, you know, you hear about people that, you know,
in prison for 30 years, right?
Yeah. In prison for 30 years, and then the DNA exonerates them. I mean, like, you right. know, that's I'm not going to be that guy for sure to do that. What I would say is that I appreciated the fact that it didn't matter that I was a city manager, and the Dickinson PD did their job as they were supposed to. And I'm proud of them for doing that. I'm also proud that they kicked it out to the sheriff's office like they were supposed to. I will say that. I will say on the other side that we have an overloaded criminal justice system because of how long it took for like my case to run its course. On something that was kind of a dead on arrival case, took an extreme amount of time. It took 11 months for the charges to be dropped. And that's
I'm totally confused there, Theo. Sorry to interrupt you. So I thought so charges weren't dropped after 2 weeks.
No,
I completely lost track of that. Oh, okay.
I was reinstated after the internal affairs investigation, but the criminal investigation. Yeah, well, and I'm not going to sit there and say they investigated this for 11 months. They didn't. Just like every other DA's office in the country, they are taxed for resources. They have to get to a case as when you have a murder.
Yeah.
You have a murder. Or are you going to take your time and say, okay, let's get off that murder case. Let's go deal with this.
To handle that DV case. Yeah. I got you. Yeah. I didn't realize your case lingered for 11 months though. Wow.
Yeah, it was 11. It was 11 months, and that's not the fault of the DA. I'm not going to fault the DA's office. I mean, it's just the reality of when you have X number of attorneys with a caseload,
right?
You know, working on my case, especially when it was a dead on arrival case, it just kind of lingered for a while. And so,
yeah, but Theo, the interesting part about that is, man, you know, there's a lot of counsels that would feel that might not be comfortable reinstating somebody until those charges are dropped. And I mean, that could be, there's literally a case right now in the Kalamazoo Township where the Kalamazoo Township manager has been on paid leave for 10 months because he's being investigated for possibly illegally taping or recording a closed session meeting that he was not a part of. And so he was on paid leave for 10 months and they just filed charges on him. And so now they terminated him, but he was on paid leave for 10 months because it was, you know, an outstanding investigation. So I didn't realize that the investigation lingered for 10, 11 months like that.
Yeah, just, I mean, it did.
Yeah. So, I mean, kudos to your counsel kudos to your counsel for bringing you back. But I mean, they had to take some political heat for that from some quarters, again, from saying, hey, how can you bring this guy back when the case hasn't been adjudicated?
Yeah, I mean, it was a very interesting time period, I would say, is that, you know, so when they reinstated me after the internal affairs investigation, and truth be told is, The internal affairs investigation pretty much found the exact same stuff that the criminal investigation later on found.
Yeah.
So really, at the end of the day, I think the council said because they were willing to invest the time early and not just wait for the criminal investigation, I would say that I think that what they want, because I mean, here's the truth of the matter is that if that internal affairs investigation came back and said, yeah, this guy's in trouble, this is not going to end well, they would have left. I mean, they would have had to. You have to. You can't. But yeah, on the other side, kudos to them. I would say is I'm very pleased working with this council, this community. Now, I will tell you is that on the other side of it is that it has been used as cannon fodder regularly at numerous council meetings and public comments on social media about the incident, even though it's been over 2 years at this point. It hasn't stopped that, but the council's been very strong and forthright about it, and I'm very blessed to work for them. You know, the council has changed over some since then, but you know, my hope is that they've seen the value in keeping me at this point, and that I've upheld my end of the bargain, that I was going to be the best public servant I can be. I'm obviously not perfect, but the point being is that, you know, I did feel like I owed them because they didn't have to take that chance.
Yeah, yeah. You know, man, Theo, this conversation, we're going to have a multi-part episode for this interview. It's just such a fascinating topic, and there's just so much to uncover, or there's just so much to talk about in the context not only of this case, but obviously what the original conversation was going to be about was the police chief situation. So this situation brings up another interesting thought that just popped in my head, and I'm really curious about this dynamic of your career and your professional advancement, Theo. You know, you have this charge, the charges are dropped because obviously it's not, there's no substance to them, but you have this black cloud as far as a Google footprint, negative PR press, the press clippings and what have you. Does that give you some pause with respect to wanting to seek out another position? Because you know that when you apply for another position, even though you've been vindicated and this has been proven or shown to not be a case at all, it's going to be used against you on all your future quests or future job applications and what have you when you're trying to get a city manager gig. Have you thought about that and how what impact this has on your career going forward? Because you still have many years left in your career. And I mean, obviously, you might be with, you know, Dickinson for the next decade, who knows? But you have to give some thought to the idea of how this is going to play out the next time you want to apply for a position. So does this affect your desire or willingness to go and seek out a new job at some point?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that I think about and, how is this going to be perceived, you know, in the future? I've been blessed to say that I've really enjoyed my time in Dickinson. I haven't really spent the time like thinking about what my next move would be, but, you know, whether it's private sector, public sector or whatnot, but I have every anticipation that if I'm ever in an executive search again in the public sector, that I'll be addressing the entire matter, the council. And truth be told is they deserve to know. I mean, they need to know. They need to know what they're buying because, you know, what's going to end up happening is I get hired somewhere, even though they've done all their homework.
Yeah.
There's going to be some naysayer in town or the first time I've told somebody no.
And that's exactly right.
They're going to go find all the
they're going to use it against you. Yep.
Posted in a new place. So the council has to know that, even though it's not true, even though vastly overblown compared to what the original story that was, you know, sold to the council was, even though all that being the case, a future council, if I were to ever transition over, has to know that's going to be a part of our relationship, if you will.
Yeah.
And you know, here's the truth of the matter. It will probably permanently.
It will. It is. Yep.
My career prospects, just truth will be told.
Yep. It will. It will. Yep. That's just the reality.
That's okay. But that's okay. Yeah, it's to me, it's the risk you take. You want to do public service. You want to serve your communities and so forth. And so, you know, there are certain things about that aspect that, for all the positives of it, you know, there's a flip side of the coin, and this is part of it. But I love what I do, and I'll work very hard to keep it from being taken away from me.
Hey, Theo, we're going to wrap up this first edition. I wasn't planning on making this a two-part episode, but we got into some pretty heavy territory. And once again, thank you so much for being willing to share such a personal, intimate story with the audience. You're walking some very unique ground, obviously, that many have not had the misfortune of walking themselves. Before we wrap up this episode and start part two, are you okay with other city managers who might be going through some very sensitive situation like this reaching out to you and as a sounding board or checking in with you if they want to go through something with, or if they want to talk to someone who's gone through something pretty serious like that? Or you have an open door policy when it comes to other city managers?
I'd be happy to. I know that there are city managers out there. Not everybody is dealing with it in the headlines like I have, and others that we've mentioned in this. Some of them are dealing with some quiet demons, maybe the way to put it, and those are just as important to deal with. So yeah, I mean, I'm always available to anybody that needs it, because we're not alone. We're not alone. And
yeah,
and truth be told, is maybe one of the reasons why I'm not terribly, I guess, jaded about the fact that my peers didn't reach out to me is because of how unique of a situation I was in. Maybe they were like, I don't even know how to relate to that.
Yeah. That's true.
What advice could I even give this guy?
Right, right. That's a very fair point. It's a very fair point. Hey, Theo, I really thank you for being on the show for part one here. We're gonna wrap this one up. Theo Melanson, Dickinson, Texas City Manager, sharing some really heavy stuff with us, really intimate, really personal details. Thank you so much. I know it's going to help a lot of city managers out there. I'm Joe Turner. This is the City Manager Unfiltered podcast. If you enjoyed the show, you enjoy content that I'm putting out there, please take a moment to rate and review the podcast on your platform of choice, especially Apple. And if you have not hit the follow or subscribe button, please do so today. Also, one more thing. I recently launched my new LinkedIn newsletter called City Manager RTRs and Job Boards. It's where I share all the different city managers and county managers who have resigned, been terminated, or retired in the previous week, so you can get a head start on what jobs are out there. If you're interested in learning more about those opportunities so you can get a head start, please go to LinkedIn and subscribe to my newsletter. I'll have a link in the show notes. Thank you very much. And then stay tuned for part two, where I'm going to interview Theo, and we're going to talk about the police chief and locking horns with your police chief and how you navigate those situations when it's time to separate or part ways with the police chief. And we all know police chiefs can have a lot of influence in their community, and that's not a fight you want to take on lightly. So we're gonna learn from his experience on that one as well, because he's got a lot to teach us. And so stay tuned for part two. Thank you.